And joining us on the book club today is When the World Seemed New by Dr. Jeffrey Engel. Dr. Engel is the founding director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University, SMU. Educated at Cornell, Oxford, the University of Wisconsin, and Yale University, he's also the author of and or editor of 10 books on foreign policy and the American presidency and When the World Seemed New, George H.W. Bush and the End of the Cold War is the book we're going to discuss today. But first, I'd like to take the time to welcome Dr. Engel. Jeff, thank you so much for being with us here today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Really good to talk to you.
Now, tell us a little bit. First of all, I mentioned a little bit about your history and being the founding director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University. Tell us a little bit about growing up. Were you always interested in history?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I was. In fact, I usually tell our incoming students that if they wind up graduating with the same major and same interest that they thought they were going to have when they arrived, that meant that we didn't do our job in exposing them to new ideas and new disciplines. And every time I say that, I feel bad because I know I did the exact opposite. I wanted to be a historian, I kid you not, from the time I was about five. Every single book I ever got or chose, my own volition, was a history book. I used to, build models and battlefields and read biographies and just have always loved history.
As you mentioned reading, I remember when I was younger, I remember they had these books. They were biographies and historical figures, and I remember reading those, and they were like about, I think, fifth or sixth grade level. So did you start reading biographies and all that at that age?
I did. In fact, one of my earliest recognitions of this was actually in Sunday school when I would read, while everybody else was focusing on other issues, I would read ahead in our sort of Bible reader, Old Testament reader, which was, rewritten for Sunday school kids to comprehend, just because as far as I could tell, it was a really good story, and I really wanted to know how it ended. So I think that's really the ultimate reason why I became a historian, is that I'm really uncomfortable with mysteries. I don't like puzzles. I like to know how something ended, and then we can start talking about it.
It's interesting that you mentioned Sunday school and Bible stories, because a lot of people don't take, and this is not necessarily the views of the staff and management of KTP, but a lot of people don't see the biblical history, especially the Old Testament, and the fact that, some of the stuff that they've uncovered in Ephesus and all that area is just incredible.
Yeah, and I think, I happen to say, and again, this, I do not represent SMU in this thought. This is just me, although I'm married to a religious historian, so I have a little bit of credibility in that ground. I like to think that it really needs to be read as a literary text, that it is a history, but like any history, it was written by individuals, and in the case of the Old Testament, it was in particular, by committee, and revised. And so I think it's important to see myself what people thought at the time and what people thought was important within the history, as we would almost with any other history text.
We're going to talk a little bit about one of the dictators that you mentioned in just a little while, but I'm going to mention him right now. Saddam Hussein, what I understand in reading, I don't remember if it's The Threatening Storm or which book, but it mentioned a little bit about the fact that he was very interested in Nebuchadnezzar, and he wanted to have a kingdom like that king.
Yes, Saddam Hussein really considered himself to be chief of the Arabs in many ways, and in particular the Western Arabs, setting himself up not only in opposition to what we would consider the West of Europe and the United States, but in particular setting himself up as the leader of a coalition against the Persian Empire. And that he thought of himself in many ways as the only one who could bring all of the Arab world together. Yes, of course, to get rid of the Zionists, that would be a nice thing from his perspective, but more importantly, to protect civilization from the real threat, who of course were the Iranians, the Persians.
We are visiting with Dr. Jeffrey Engel. Jeff is the author of When the World Seemed New, George H.W. Bush and the End of the Cold War. And it's interesting, this week as we celebrate, and not really celebrate, but remember the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, the fact that a lot of people, remember the Cold War and how close it was during that Cuban Missile Crisis in October.
Yes, in fact, it's one of the things I found really fascinating in my teaching is now, at this moment in history, our students have no memory of the Cold War. In fact, it's going to be only a couple of years until they were born after 9/11. And so it's really difficult to get students to appreciate just what a big deal the Cold War was, and more importantly, that the end was not inevitable. I mean, I think the way that we look back as an American society now, competition between capitalism and communism was, of course, capitalism was going to win. It's clearly the better system. You know, if you were to take bets in the mid-1950s, which side was going to win, you'd probably get better odds on the communists around the world. So to try to impress upon the students two things. First, that this was a dynamic competition of which was not entirely sure how it was going to turn out. And the second thing, which I think is actually really important for us today, is we often hear politicians in our own day, 2017, talking about existential crises, referring to Al-Qaeda or ISIS as an existential threat to the United States. Yes, they are threats. When the Soviet Union had 20,000 nuclear weapons pointed at the Western world and at the United States, that's a real existential threat. I mean, that would just wipe out existence by definition. So it's important, I think, to understand not only how contingent the Cold War was, but how dangerous it was as well.
A lot of people would say, what is the use of these nuclear weapons? Because one side fires them and somebody else responds, then nobody wins.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, the only use that I can see really is for deterrence. And I actually am a believer in deterrence. But I think one of the things that we have forgotten from the Cold War and actually have a leftover from the Cold War is because these weapons are more powerful than we can possibly appreciate. I mean, it's no exaggeration to say the bombs that exploded over Hiroshima and Nagasaki are basically cap guns compared to the destructive power of what we have today. We, in a sense, have forgotten that just a few might be enough. And by just a few, I mean perhaps even, you know, a couple dozen, a couple hundred. You know, the fact that we have several thousand still in our arsenal and are continuing to expand that arsenal and update that arsenal under the new administration, I really think is a fundamental misunderstanding of how these weapons work, because they are designed not to be used. They're designed to intimidate, and if you ever press the button, everything has gone terribly wrong.
We are visiting with Jeffrey Engel. Jeffrey is the author of When the World Seemed New, and this is a book about George H.W. Bush and the end of the Cold War. And we're going to talk a little bit about, well, a lot about the book in general, but I want to take advantage of the fact that we have a presidential historian with us today. And I want to go back to President Eisenhower and the fact that when there were troubles brewing in Korea, he was very hesitant to use any of these bombs because of what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And correct me if I'm wrong, but some of his generals and other people were pushing him to kind of do it.
Well, this is actually the same story for President Truman and for President Eisenhower, that the commanders in the field, Douglas MacArthur most famously, of course, during the Truman era, wanted to use small nuclear weapons. It's an oxymoron, of course, but that's what they had called them, small nuclear weapons, especially on Chinese ports in order to intimidate the Chinese, to get the Chinese out. And each man who was ultimately responsible, Truman and then Eisenhower, recognized that that might be a useful idea from the theater commander's position. That is, if you're trying to win in Korea, you really might want the Chinese to stop giving supplies to the Koreans and sending troops to the Koreans. But if you're only the theater commander in Korea, you might miss the broader picture, which is that if you drop a nuclear bomb on Shanghai, the next one's probably going to be dropped by the Russians on Paris or London. So each president is charged with looking at things globally. And really, because of that, neither of them was willing to take this extra step. It's important to note that Eisenhower threatened the use of nuclear weapons. And that was, I think, a significant fact in helping the North Koreans and the Chinese essentially decide ultimately to the armistice. But at no point did I think that he actively considered their use. In fact, he actually was very famously behind the scenes, of course, by famous, I mean, now that we know from the documents, argued against using nuclear weapons in 1954 at Dien Bien Phu in Indochina. And his basic argument was, you know, dropping one of these things, there's no going back. And he also said, made a really interesting point in his, to his National Security Council, which is that if we, the United States, drop one of these on an Asian nation again, because we're the only people that have ever done it, and the people we did it to were the Asian people, well, then the United States is done in Asia forever, that we would have no particular standing or reputation ever again, and that just wasn't worth it.
This is a Thanksgiving week, Jeff, and interestingly enough, your book opens, not the introduction, but chapter one talks about, you know, Thanksgiving week, and President Reagan is getting ready to do what presidents do on Thanksgiving.
Yeah, you know, he's getting ready to pardon the turkey, and more importantly, it's 1988, and he's getting ready to retire. His successor, George Bush, has already been elected, and Reagan, as far as he's concerned, has just been voted effectively a third term by the American people, but a third term that he doesn't have to serve. He gets to go back to California and really take the retirement that at that point he was longing for. But before doing that, he wanted to say thanks to one of his closest allies over the course of his administration, who was Margaret Thatcher, the Iron Lady, the Prime Minister of Great Britain. She and Reagan have been allied intellectually and ideologically for his entire administration. And he wanted to say thank you, invited Margaret Thatcher over. And Margaret Thatcher, in essence, gave a press conference after speaking with Reagan, speaking with George Bush, in which she declared the Cold War was over and that all the new administration had to do was follow the path of the old administration, which, of course, was not at all what the new administration actually wanted to do. It was a really fascinating moment where Margaret Thatcher essentially proclaimed something publicly and gave the impression that she had the incoming president-elect's views. But it turns out that President Bush was really wary of the Soviets and really concerned that perhaps all this talk of reform and perestroika and peace that President Reagan had promised working with Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev, perhaps it was just an illusion, and that we need to be more on our guard towards the Soviets than Reagan had been.
This book talks about the world when it seemed new and the end of the Cold War. And in the publicity reports and everything else that has come out promoting this great book is the fact that, you know, the Soviet Union has collapsed. It was one of the greatest shocks, not to the nation, but to the world in general, since, I guess, World War II. And then we talked earlier about Saddam Hussein and what he wanted to do. And as you mentioned, he proclaimed himself chief of the Arabs, and he chooses to invade Kuwait. And then all of a sudden, China is cracking down on its protesters there. So this is something that President Bush all of a sudden is going, wow, you know, I mean, not wow, I'm sure he already had you know, plans and stuff going on because, well, we'll talk a little bit about that in a bit, but go ahead and kind of fill us in there.
So we oftentimes remember this period because it worked out well. We remember it well. We remember it optimistically. We remember it halcyonically. We remember it as a time of American triumph and in many ways American hegemony, and also a time when the United States was remarkably popular throughout the world. The world seemed to be moving our way, as I like to say. In truth, it was remarkably dangerous and tumultuous. It turns out, from my perspective, that George Bush faced more distinct, difficult foreign policy crises over his 4 years than any other president over a similar four-year period in American history. Not only do we have the fall of the Soviet Union, we have the reunification of Germany, we have the collapse of European communism, we have Tiananmen Square, we have American military operation in Panama, and of course then the Gulf War, which is the largest U.S. military operation since the Vietnam War, and by the way, it still is the largest since the Vietnam War. All those things happened in a four-year period, and frankly, one or two of them would have been enough to occupy the typical administration's time over the course of 4 years. So it's really a remarkable period. And the best way, I think, to understand it broadly is that the collapse of communism and the fall of the Soviet Union in particular is really best understood as the end of an empire, because the Soviet Union, at the end of the day, was an empire. It controlled other people geopolitically, diplomatically, and also ideologically. And historically, all throughout time, whenever a great power or a great empire falls, a great power war subsequently ensues, because something has to fill the vacuum. If you want to think of it as essentially when a tectonic change occurs to the international system like this, I like to think of it as essentially a giant snow globe that shakes the snow globe and nobody quite knows where all the different pieces are going to wind up settling. And ultimately, a war invariably occurs during that time. And we've never actually run that experiment before with the nuclear weapons that you and I just discussed in the mix. So when we look back on the end of the Cold War and the fall of the Soviet Union, it's actually remarkable that we survived, as far as I'm concerned. I would not want to run this experiment again and presume that we would come out just as well. And I think one of the reasons we survived was because we now know of the calm and prudent and judicious leadership behind the scenes, people like George Bush.
And we're talking about George Bush Sr., correct?
Yes, George Bush Sr.
Now, tell us a little bit about, and you and I discussed this a little bit before the interview started, the fact that President Bush's calm and collected ways, the fact that what he did, a lot of patience, very different or if you would compare it to what's going on now and the situation in the war involving also Russia because of other events and Korea, North Korea.
Yeah, it's really hard for me to think of a person, two people who are less alike in temperament and in government ability, governing ability and governing style than the senior President Bush and Donald Trump. The senior President Bush was arguably the most experienced person to ever occupy the Oval Office. He had the longest government resume, if you will. He had been a senator. He had been director of the CIA. If I told you all of his government roles, we'd spend the rest of the conversation talking about it. He also was a man who essentially was known for judiciousness, for judgment, for being calm at times of particular difficulty. And also, and I think this is the most important thing, he was willing, we now know, because we have a whole slew of new, recently declassified documents that really allow us to peer into the Oval Office during his presidency, he was consistently willing to sacrifice his public reputation and his standing in the polls with the American people if he thought that doing nothing or doing something quietly or doing something behind the scenes in the midst of a crisis was actually the best course for the country. So when people around the country saw a crisis like Tiananmen Square or saw a tumultuous event like the fall of the Berlin Wall and wanted their president to stand up and act and beat his chest or be the moral condemner of the world, as in the case of Tiananmen, Bush refused for a variety of reasons, most of which was he thought his words from the Oval Office would echo around the world, and he thought that his words would actually, if they echoed too much, might hurt American interests. And so he was more than willing to do what he thought best for the country, even at the sake of his own poll numbers. Frankly, that's not a sentence I would ever use for our current president, who clearly seems much more concerned about how he is portrayed and about his personal numbers than necessarily about the long-term fate of the nation and the long-term fate of his office. And it's really remarkable when we think about a president like George Bush, who was quiet, judicious, spoke behind the scenes. It's hard to think of a different, more apt comparison. I like to say, of course, President Bush didn't have Twitter when he was in office, but even if he had had it, he wouldn't have used it.
You took the words out of my mouth because I was going to say social media wasn't around back then. And so President Bush, again, even if it had been around, he was more or less just ready to just sit back and, because of his resume, as you mentioned, pick up the phone and talk to world leaders about what was going on.
Not only pick up the phone and talk to world leaders, but again, using the Twitter example, then not tell the world that he was talking to world leaders, because that would set press expectations or public expectations. So, you know, the idea that President Bush would at any point go out and call a foreign leader a bad name or insult them or even say that we were talking to them in the midst of a crisis, that doesn't help from his perspective. What you really want in the midst of a crisis, or even when there's no crisis but you're trying to build a long-term relationship, is the ability to speak quietly but confidently, the ability to speak in a manner that your adversary or ally knows they can trust what you say, which takes time. You have to build trust over time. And also the ability, and this is really the key, for the ally or adversary to know that whatever they say to you in confidence will stay in confidence, that you are not going to release it to the world. And if you're a leader like Mikhail Gorbachev, or if you're a leader like Deng Xiaoping, who are facing really existential crises for their own governments, and you have to make difficult decisions, you want to be able to talk that out with the President of the United States and know that what you say isn't going to be on the front page of the paper the next day or isn't going to be tweeted in the next hour.
We're visiting with Jeffrey Engel. Jeffrey is a presidential historian. He is at SMU. He is the founding director of the Center for Presidential History at SMU. And he is the author of the new book, When the World Seemed New, George H.W. Bush and the End of the Cold War. One of the things that some people, I don't want to say argue, but might say helped President Bush Sr. is his government resume, but also the fact that he was the director of the CIA for so long, so he knew a little bit about secrecy and covert affairs?
Yeah, you know, I like to think that really, in a broader sense, he knew a little bit or a lot about everything. You know, that he had that experience, of course, in the CIA, so he understood how the CIA worked. He also, I think even more importantly, had been ambassador from the United States to the United Nations, and then ambassador from the United States, de facto ambassador to China. Say de facto because we hadn't established full diplomatic relations yet, but everybody recognized he was essentially the ambassador. And that really gave him the experience to know how diplomacy worked and how conversations across cultures worked and how you had to build these conversations over time. As he liked to say, this is a quote from the book, one of the things he really learned while working at the United Nations was that everybody values their own sovereignty. Every country thinks they're important. As he likes to say, the sovereignty of Burundi is just as important to those people as ours is to us. And that we have to recognize whenever we enter a diplomatic situation that the rest of the world, you know, has interests too and has perspectives too. And even if we're going to make sure that our interests prevail, we do better if we listen and hear what our allies and adversaries are saying, even if ultimately we're going to try to convince them of the righteousness of our cause.
Jeff, tell us, as a presidential historian, and obviously, you know, you've studied and read a lot about what's going on with different world leaders. And some people might ask, well, what's going on with our world today, Jeff, and how would you describe it?
You know, that's a great question. So the answer I'm going to give you is either going to, it's a real Rorschach test. It's either going to scare the bejesus out of you, or it's going to make you stand up and cheer. And the answer is this, which is that President Trump is rejecting every single fundamental axiom of American foreign policy since 1945. Since 1945, and since the creation of the post-World War II world, which the United States largely created, we believe that the world did we did better when the world did better. We believe that the world was better off with American leadership, and more importantly, that American leadership, and military leadership especially, was a good investment because it would prevent war, that prevent global war, that that's actually much, much cheaper to sail ships around the world and keep the global commons going, to have bases around the world and keep global trade safe, than it ever was to try to mount an expedition somewhere in the world on a large scale. And most importantly, that the United States would be the moral leader of the world, essentially arguing for not only an expansion of democracy, but more fundamentally for human rights around the world, that we were the place that people look to, if you will, for global goodness. And really, that can't be understated. And President Trump obviously has a completely different perspective, that he thinks the United States shouldn't lead the world. The United States should care only about the United States, and that the United States should be able to use its military strength for its own interests and not necessarily for anyone else's. And President Trump, as evidenced by his last visit to China, is apparently not really interested in having any discussion whatsoever about the question of human rights. In fact, President Trump appears to be more interested in authoritarian leaders and authoritarian rule styles of governing and authoritarian leaders than previous presidents have been.
So is there any other period in history or other leader that we can compare currently to what's going on? Or is it completely new?
Vladimir Lenin.
Ah.
As a person who really wanted to upend the entire international system and rework all the rules and throw out the old system in large part because it was the old system, I'm quite sure that Trump would not appreciate the analogy to Lenin. But I think, honestly, they're equally dangerous to the international system. I have to say, I try to avoid making, you know, political statements when I'm discussing my history work, but I think it's important to take a stand every now and then. And I have to say that I am as afraid of the instability of the international system caused by our president as I've ever been in my entire life. And more importantly, I cannot think of any more unstable moment in the international system back through until perhaps 1919 or 1939, and neither of those situations turned out well for the world.
We are visiting with historian Jeffrey Engel. He is the author of the book, When the World Seemed New, George H.W. Bush and the End of the Cold War. This book, as you mentioned, is based a lot on a lot of research because of historians do so much research. But when you started writing this book, did you kind of, because as we mentioned earlier, today some of the people don't even realize what the Cold War is or was, and also 9/11 is soon going to be children born afterwards. Did you know or have any idea how you were going to kind of end this book and explain to people, How is the story of the Cold War's end different from any other?
You know, when I started writing this book, it was about 10 years ago, so certainly before any of the situation that we're seeing today, but also, importantly, before any of the real Russian-American antagonism that we're seeing today, or at least Russian-American antagonism on the level that we're seeing today. So when I wrote the book, it was essentially a book that was first as a piece of history to uncover what actually happened, and we had a whole slew of new documents from a massive declassification project that really allowed us to see what was going on in a new way. So the first rule for every historian, I think, is to tell what happened. And then the second lesson, if you will, which I want to impart from this period, was that the United States has a good story to tell. And when things are going your way, because you believe in the fundamentals of your country, you believe in the fundamentals of democracy, and you believe in the fundamentals of free speech, and you believe in the fundamentals of the free market, because of all those things, when the world is going your way, you really are best not to change course. And that ultimately, I think, in the long trajectory of history, the downturns that we've seen over the last several years that are animating previous administrations, that animates the current conflict in American politics, those are perhaps bumps in the road, but they are not necessarily forks in the road, and that we should continue on the path of what ultimately made us great, which was, up to my mind, keeping on the path of the values and the systems and the world leadership that had really been productive for the United States since 1945.
We have been visiting with Dr. Jeffrey Engel. Dr. Engel is an historian. He is the founding director of the Center for Presidential History at SMU. And the book is called When the World Seemed New, George H.W. Bush and the End of the Cold War. Jeff, if you wouldn't mind telling us, because of social media, if there's a web page or Facebook page that people can go to find out more, not just about the book, but also about, you know, some of the things that you've been discussing.
Yeah, you know, I think the best place to look is our Center for Presidential History website, because we cover presidential history, and we investigate presidential history from George Washington all the way till today. And that you can just go to www.smu.edu/CPH, or you can just Google Southern Methodist University Presidential History and it will pop right up.
Again, that website is www.smu.edu/CPH, or Center for Presidential History. And the book, again, is When the World Seemed New, George H.W. Bush and the End of the Cold War. We've been visiting with Dr. Jeffrey Engel, who is the founding director of the Center for Presidential History at SMU. Jeff, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, really? It was a great conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTEP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Lauren Terrazas. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.